Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is Reset. Assisted living communities have been hit hard by the COVID crisis. Coming up in the second half of the podcast, we check in with someone who runs senior living communities and find out if new money from the federal government will be enough to keep those places safe. But first, it feels like years, but we've just reached the six-month mark in the COVID crisis here in Illinois. It's as good a time as any to take a closer look at how the pandemic has fundamentally changed the state. From budget busting to unemployment, hospital protocols to the restaurant industry, a new story out in Crane Chicago Business tracks how much has changed in such a short amount of time. The writers of the story are A.D. Quigg and Stephanie Goldberg. A.D., this is almost an oral history of the last 6 months. Who did you talk to for this article?
We spoke with as many government leaders as we could. Ankapar, Governor Pritzker's chief of staff, Governor Pritzker, the heads of the Chicago and Illinois Departments of Public Health, folks at the Illinois Restaurant Association, Illinois manufacturers. Stephanie spoke with a lot of folks in the healthcare field. I spoke with Damon Jones, an economist at the University of Chicago. We tried to get as many folks as we could from as many different industries as we could, just to kind of get a sense of, you know, this has touched every industry, every business, every person's life, and tons of families who were impacted by someone in their family who was infected, someone who died, or living and working under kind of the threat of the infection.
When you look at the timeline of this, Stephanie, and you see state and local officials who had to respond quickly to this emergency at the point, which everyone was, including them, were wildly unprepared for. What were the pivotal moments in Illinois? When you look back at the 6 months, what were the tipping points for this pandemic?
You know, it's funny. AD and I put a timeline together really before we started to get going on this, because we wanted to make sure that we weren't forgetting things. Like, I think we even wrote in the story, like, March was a whirlwind. Like, it's so crazy to think back at everything that happened in a fairly short period of time. And from the time of the first confirmed case on January 24th, until probably like March 9th, when Governor Pritzker issued the disaster declaration, it didn't seem like life had changed that much. And then all of a sudden, in that moment, everything was different. A couple things happened that week. March 13th, schools were ordered to close. You know, March 11th, the St. Patrick's Day parades were canceled, which I think at the time they were postponed. You know, everyone was thinking, maybe we'll have these soon. Travel restrictions led to overcrowding at O'Hare. You know, everyone remembers the scenes from that day. So March was just sort of this nutty month where everything happened so quickly. And then I think by the time April rolled around, everyone was sort of getting comfortable with the stay-at-home order and relatively speaking, I suppose, but it was a big few weeks that we had in there.
It's amazing to think about, too, to think 6 months, because I remember in March myself when the St. Patrick's Day parade was canceled and schools were closed. You know, everyone was talking about, May? May 1st
as an
opportunity. August was millions of years away. But to think that we've had the 6 months that we've had, it almost felt like we weren't prepared for this to be this long, AD.
Well, and one of the startling parts of putting the timeline together was seeing how quickly the cases grew. One thing Dr. Allison Arwady, the head of the Chicago Department of Public Health, told me, in epidemiology, yes, we care about the case count, but we care even more about what that curve looks like. And we were seeing an exponential rise in cases. So that the day the St. Patrick's Day parade was canceled, there were 25 cases in the state. And by the time the stay-at-home order was extended in Illinois on March 31st, there were 6,000 cases in Illinois. It really ramped up quickly. And those first weeks were, I don't know how many times we heard and we said the terms bending the curve. Folks were trying to avoid what we started to see happening in New York City. We started that work on the McCormick Place alternate care facility that we ultimately didn't really end up using that much. But we were terrified that we would have hospitals and clinics overrun, or perhaps what happened in New York, where you had people, so many calls for service that people couldn't even get an ambulance and many people were dying in their homes.
Stephanie, you cover a lot of healthcare issues for the state of Illinois, for Cranes. I think about almost the way that Illinois has changed forever when you think about the protocols for hospitals and healthcare when it comes to COVID-19. At the beginning, the storyline was really about hospital preparedness, PPE or lack of, trying to get ventilators. all the kind of things to get us quickly prepared for this emergency. As we look at how it played out over 6 months' time, how has that story changed, and how has the healthcare facilities and the hospitals in our area evolved?
They're still evolving. And this is one of those things, when you ask hospital CEOs now that question, they sort of chuckle. Although there's a lot that's still in flux at the moment, because I think a lot of folks are preparing right now for this potential second wave that we have been hearing a lot about that's going to coincide with flu season. So the stockpiles of PPE are continuing to grow. So that is very much still a thing. What hospitals look like in the future are likely going to change. I mean, the negative pressure rooms that help isolate the virus, some hospitals have the capacity to like change their emergency rooms into those units. That's going to be a bigger thing in the future, their ability to flex up and down as, you know, ICUs need to expand. So there are lots of changes to facilities as well as just protocols. I think it's going to be a while before visitors are allowed in hospitals again, you know, certainly not this fall. So the way healthcare is delivered inevitably is going to have to change. But what that looks like is still sort of remains to be seen.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some of the other industries affected, because we have seen so much devastation when it comes to our industries and our economy here in the state of Illinois, from restaurants, as we've talked about over and over ad nauseum on this program, but also all the others where we saw mass layoffs and record unemployment in the last 6 months.
Right. We spoke with Mark Densler, who's the head of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. And, you know, part of the issue with COVID was also just changing consumer demands. So we had a lot of industries shifting to make things that they hadn't made before, or turning off profitable lines to help Illinois either with PPE or with testing. Mark Densler said, you know, AbbVie started making reagents to help with testing on their lines. You know, you start with 2,000 a week, then it was 5,000 a week. Illinois could not have gotten up to the massive number of tests that we're now running daily without that. Abbott made that controversial rapid test that was so promoted by the White House. You had other companies like Richards Wilcox. They were a metal shelving company. Nobody was buying metal shelving companies. And they flipped over in a matter of days and began making hospital beds mm-hmm. for the McCormick Place site, which were treated with kind of that antimicrobial spray. Tons of liquor manufacturers started making hand sanitizers. There are people that were like, well, I can't make any one thing, but I can make certain parts. So you had people switch to making ventilator parts. And you also just had massive demand at grocery stores because folks weren't going out to eat quite as much. Early on, we had that run on toilet paper, mm-hmm. on right. cleaning products. Folks in the shipping industry had to work with the state and national Department of Transportation to get shipping modifications to basically allow for them to ship more, for workers to work longer hours, and for heavier loads to be carried. It's still evolving. You know, like we still have a lot of people grocery shopping instead of going to restaurants. Of course, we have this completely different shifting landscape for restaurants here because the city keeps kind of opening up and then pulling slightly back when we see infection rates change.
And we haven't yet even figured out how this is all going to work when the weather's not nice. When you can't do outdoor patios, which will be coming up, I would assume, right after, which is the way it
right.
works in Chicago at any time. But that's something that we haven't figured out yet. And Stephanie, when we think about some of the other things we haven't figured out, and we from education and remote learning to we were talking about just about how prepared everybody is for a second wave, there are still a lot of unanswered questions, even 6 months in.
Yeah, I think something that we are not talking about enough, although these conversations are, you know, continuing in earnest, but the technology divide right now is a really big issue. I read a great story this morning from Kaiser Health News about how that impacts nursing home residents. You know, if you have Wi-Fi and you have technology, you can communicate with your family. If you don't, you cannot. That obviously is a big issue when we talk about e-learning and remote work as well. So, and also telemedicine, like if you need to see your doctor, but you're a high risk patient and it's not safe for you to go to a facility, like, do you have the means to connect with them remotely? So that is something that I think that conversation is going to need to continue as we head into the winter months.
Yeah, and AD, we'll have more conversations about how this is budget busting and how our municipalities across the state of Illinois, including the state house downstate, have just thrown tons of money at this, and there will be a bill due at some point when it comes to massive deficits. But when I think about what is the future, you know, there's so many different areas that have still not been able to figure out which is the right way to go. And as you talk to all these civic leaders and these business leaders in this Crane Chicago business piece, are they optimistic? Are they pessimistic? What's the vibe you're getting from everybody about what's next when we look forward on this COVID-19 pandemic?
I think it's a lot of kind of continuing to buckle down. One kind of really impactful moment for me during all of this was speaking with Governor Pritzker. I said, you know, 7,300 people have died in Illinois in the past 6 months, and you are the person with the most power in the state. Have you had time to grieve? And he paused for a really long time and he said, no. And I don't think really anyone has had time to grieve, because every day there's something new popping up. And something Dr. Arwady told me was, you know, initially she told me this is the first quarter of the COVID fight this past 6 months. And then I asked her about it again, and she said, you know, it's not even really the first quarter, because when we do get a vaccine, that might be a two-treatment vaccine, meaning people have to go once, and then they have to go again. Mm. And it will take at least a year, possibly two, maybe three, to fully roll that vaccine right out. And then we don't know, number one, how effective it is. It might be 60% effective. So this might not be we eradicate COVID. It might be we figure out a new way to live with it day in and day out. But there's also people, you know, striking a hopeful note saying, we have done some really incredible work on equity to house the homeless, to release a lot of people from the Cook County Jail, to bring food to communities that might not have had it in the past. So the hopeful folks are saying maybe there are some solutions to human problems that we have solved during this pandemic that will last.
Well, great story. ChicagoBusiness.com is the website. Crane Chicago Business Reporters, A.D. Quigg and Stephanie Goldberg, put it together. Appreciate you guys coming on with us today, and we'll talk soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After weeks of lobbying, the assisted living industry finally got the White House's attention. President Trump pledged $5 billion in aid for U.S. nursing homes and assisted living facilities. It's no secret that older people and the facilities they live in have been hit hard by COVID-19. Some stats even suggest that deaths in nursing homes account for more than 40% of all fatalities in the U.S. And here in Illinois, that number has even been higher, hanging around 50%. So this new money comes with new testing and training protocols. But will it be enough? Gus Noble is president of Chicago Scots, an organization that runs senior living facilities in the western suburbs. Gus, welcome to Reset.
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Good to talk with you. All right, so what do you make of the new additional funding coming from the White House? What impact is it going to have?
Well, it's obviously every single penny, every single support we can get is appreciated, and we need all the help we can get. We've relied on sources both inside and outside our community to help us get essential items of PPE and testing. And so we're grateful to whomsoever gets us the support. I'm encouraged that everybody is taking this as seriously as they can, because these are the most vulnerable citizens among us, are the people who live in long-term care. And I've said from day one of this crisis that the best way to protect the health and safety of the people living in long-term care is to protect the health and safety of the people working in long-term care. So all this is a great move in the right direction.
Yeah. When I talked to you back in March, you were part of a move to try and get the governor's attention, to try and get the president's attention, to say that you needed more resources when it comes to fighting COVID-19 at long-term facilities in the state and in this area. Were your concerns heard, and do you feel at this point that you got the necessary resources you needed?
They're certainly being heard. Whether they're heard at all levels, I can't say yet. But what I can say is talk locally here in Illinois. IDPH, the governor, Dr. Ezeke, and her team at IDPH have been incredible in their support, their guidance, and their leadership. We committed to what I believe is the most proactive, vigorous model of testing in the state. We test everyone every week on our campus, whether you work here, live here, or you're coming to provide a service. If you step foot inside the building, you're going to be tested. And that's allowed us, now we're entering 14 weeks of weekly testing. This has allowed us to be guided by certainty rather than speculation. And I credit Governor Pritzker and IDPH for that incredible service.
Gus, what does life look like behind the locked doors of senior living communities? We can't visit, we can't go in. So how's it changed?
Well, certainly here at Caledonia Senior Living, and I know through my professional friendships with the other communities in the area, we've really worked hard pre-COVID to be guided by feelings of home and family and not institutional, to be as uninstitutional as possible. And obviously when you go into a restricted type of lockdown, it's harder to be focused on home. However, what we've done is assemble our staff and have regular meetings with them. And I've said to them, one silver lining about having locked our front doors is that we are in charge. We can make decisions about what happens within the community. We're all in this together. We're only as good as the protection that we offer to one another. So I'm making a commitment to you that I will be as careful and cautious as I can be when I'm outside the community and inside the community, and I'm asking you to make the same commitment. The other commitment we're making is if we cannot be as focused on feelings of home and family in the general operation of our campuses, then we have to dignify human interaction even more than we did previously.
Yeah, right.
So our staff are being incredible. They are just stepping up in ways that are truly heroic. I see them make sure residents are comfortable and want to be comforted. I see them using what technologies we have currently to bring life enrichment activities and exercise into resident rooms, meals and so on. And we've used this new in-house TV system that we have, and others are doing the same, to stream content that shows that there is a connection, even though the doors are locked to the outside world.
Gus, so much of what you do, and as you talk about home, is not just managing the people that live inside, but also the families that live outside.
Yep.
How does the relationship evolve with the families on the outside who don't have access like they had before to their loved ones on the inside?
We immediately started to see how we could create opportunities for families to connect using technologies like FaceTime and so on. But beyond that, we tried to look at window time for families to connect. And fortunately, we have this campus which is in the middle of the forest preserve with this beautiful landscape around us and walking paths and so on. And it allowed us to create moments for families to come for picnics outside resident rooms. One moment, it just blew me away. We're a Scottish community here. And pre-COVID, we had a dance studio, and these Highland dancers would come in every week, rehearse and use the dance studio. But in that process, they got to know our residents in really close ways. The moment the lockdown happened, they created resident-to-dancer pen pal friendships and writing and so on. But one Tuesday afternoon, I heard the strains of bagpipes playing outside the campus, and I looked, and outside every resident window, there was a dancer performing for their residents. And 14 weeks into this, they're doing it every Tuesday, come rain or shine.
Wow.
And it's just an incredible thing that this community is doing here in North Riverside, but I see this type of thing in long-term care all over the country.
Gus, when I think about the emotion that goes with that, with trying to keep connection as a priority, I also think that, the stats that I read at the beginning of the segment, just about 40% nationwide deaths occur in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, higher here in Illinois. How do you deal with that as somebody who is at the forefront, but also the fears of both the people who live in the facilities and also families that are concerned about their loved ones that are in your facilities?
Well, you cannot be too careful. Going into this crisis, the administrator here, Chris Cortez is her name. I have such incredible admiration for her. She said to us in a very calm way, if we overreact to this crisis, we will probably never know. If we underreact, we will know immediately. So we created systems of hand hygiene, screening, physical distancing. We put testing at the heart of our protocol, And we also created a time and symptoms-based monitoring approach. This allowed us to really give an assurance to the people who live and work here that we are taking this incredibly seriously. And we have in our hands an obligation to deliver care to everyone, to relieve the stress and distress of everyone who lives and works here. And that comes in many different forms. We've been mindful from day one of physical health, but we're also thinking of social, emotional, spiritual, and mental health, the staff and the residents. And I should say that in this era of civil unrest, when the protests turned to some rioting and so on, I thought it was important that, again, that we as a staff got together and we recognized that the dignification of relationships weren't just focused on the residents. This was staff to staff. And we had an obligation to recognize that the black and brown members of our team were under greater stress and greater threat than us. So we wanted to say to them that behind the locked doors, this is our opportunity to create a safe and dignified space for one another.
And that seems to be the mantra here, the safe and dignified space. When you look at the evolution, we just talked with Crane Chicago Business right before talking to you, just this idea of the evolution of you know, industries from March to August and beyond. What has to evolve when it comes to the long-term care industry?
I know we'll be one of the last to open up once COVID is done. Now, if you look at the governor's plan of reopening Restore Illinois, phase five is when the plan says COVID-19 is defeated. Created a plan here at Caledonia Senior Living that is in lockstep. It will never get ahead of Restore Illinois, but it's certainly being informed and guided by it. And I wrote in the plan, COVID-19 is defeated. And I have to say that the lift that gave me of thinking of a world beyond the restriction that we're in was very inspirational. So we shared this plan amongst our families that are related to residents, our staff, our board, our community. And by the way, we host regular, since lockdown, we thought it was important that families had an opportunity to connect to and engage with staff at all levels. So we have regular Zoom calls where we have all of our department heads and families have an opportunity to ask us questions about life, about our operations, about our protocols and protections, as well as the reopening plan. And the first step of that plan, the first step to getting back to some type of normality, had to focus in all of our minds on getting families physically connected with the resident. And so we created outside socially or physically distanced visits with supported by and supervised by members of the team. And that has really helped the residents and families feel that they not only are relying on us for safety, but for well-being in many different ways.
It's Gus Noble. He's the president of Chicago Scots, an organization that runs senior living facilities in the western suburbs. Gus, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Please be well, Justin.
And that's today's Reset. For the latest, most accurate info on the COVID-19 crisis, head to 91.5 WBEZ or to WBEZ.org. I'm Justin Kaufman. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you here tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.